Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up later this week, tomorrow, Connecticut Republican Senate hopeful Peter Schiff. Maybe you know him from CNBC. Now he's running for Senate. Thursday, Krista Tippett. Friday, Henry Louis Gates. A lot to listen for every morning at 10. And it's common to see stories in the news suggesting that kids are being overdiagnosed and overmedicated for disorders like ADHD, bipolar, obsessive compulsive disorder, and autism, and anything on that spectrum. The big bad culprit is often Big Pharma, the psychiatrists who are supposedly in bed with Big Pharma, and lazy parents who want perfect kids. People say these kids are the canaries in the coal mine of our out-of-whack society. Well, Judith Warner, contributing writer for The New York Times and The New York Times Magazine, started out with these kinds of assumptions when she began writing her new book, but she ended up coming to a very different conclusion about children, mental illness, and why the conversation about how to treat real kids has to change. Judith Warner is here. Her new book is called We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. Judith, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And it is undoubtedly true that kids are diagnosed with ADHD, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, autism, Asperger's, more now than at any time in our history. So what's changed if they're not being overdiagnosed?
All of the diagnostic categories have changed. The way of viewing children has changed. What we expect children to be able to experience, in a sense, has changed. There was a belief before the 1970s that children couldn't even suffer from depression. There was a belief before the 1990s that anyone younger than an adult couldn't have bipolar disorder. If you don't believe that these disorders can possibly exist in kids, then you're absolutely not going to find them, and you're going to have low or non-existent levels of diagnosis.
So we hear stats like Ritalin use has increased 600%. A fifth of white fifth graders who are boys have ADHD. Are those real numbers?
They are not real numbers. They're numbers that have been bandied around for a very, very long time. They're old numbers that rested on misunderstandings of data. The 600% rate of increase for Ritalin in the early 1990s had to do with production figures for the production of Ritalin from the DEA. Basically, there was a shortage of Ritalin in the early 1990s. Kids in some parts of the country weren't able to get their medication at all. The DEA, which oversees this kind of thing, ordered up a massive ramping up of production, and that's what you're seeing reflected in that number, the true increase in Ritalin use. And there was an increase. There was a sizable increase because more kids were being diagnosed. The definition of ADHD was being expanded in that period of time to bring in more kids. The use went up, but it didn't go up anywhere near 600%.
So parents, teachers, guidance counselors, mental health professionals, if you have firsthand experience dealing with mental health issues and kids, give us a call. How has it been for you trying to negotiate your understanding if, say, your child does indeed have what appears to be a mental disorder and you don't want to diagnose them, but you don't know what's going on, or if their behavior is on a normal spectrum, whatever normal means? What has your experience been trying to understand, trying to get medical attention, trying to make these medication decisions? Give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC, or comment or ask a question online at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. For Judith Warner from the New York Times, author now of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. And you say, Judith, that our impulse is to see kids as the canaries in the coal mine of our sick, overly competitive, out-of-whack society. Do you think society causes the kinds of disorders that you're writing about?
No, society couldn't possibly simply cause the kinds of disorders that I've been writing about. If that were the case, then all children would have them. It's way too simplistic a formulation. You know, the way that it's understood scientifically now is that biology loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. Kids come into the world with certain kinds of temperaments, strengths, weaknesses, brain structures, functions, and then they encounter the world around them. And what happens to them, what they see, what kind of stimuli they get, bring on different kinds of responses.
But that's not to let society, quote unquote, off the hook. I mean, to take another medical example, we see the huge spike in diabetes now. And maybe people who would have had the genes for diabetes never had the disease express in past generations because we eat so differently right now, which is a societal function with all the sugar and et cetera. So maybe the same thing is happening on a behavioral level with respect to ADHD, Asperger's, and so forth.
I think that could be. And yet at the same time, it's natural for us to think that because we're obviously in a parenting culture that's out of whack. We have a culture of childhood that is indisputably out of whack. Kids are facing greatly increased academic demands, all kinds of social pressures, all kinds of worries about money and about their future, and a very narrow sort of road to success that wasn't necessarily the case in previous generations. And so there's reason to think that our society is toxic and that all of this toxicity could bring out symptoms in kids. But the problem is you can look at numbers and you can argue them many different ways. There are some people who present numbers to show that kids are doing worse than ever before. There are some people who have numbers to show that kids are doing better than ever before. For example, teen suicide rate went down to a point that hadn't been seen over, in 30 years in 2003. It went slightly back up when doctors stopped prescribing SSRIs, when they became worried about that and the FDA warning.
Antidepressants.
Antidepressants, that's right. There are a lot of other social indicators that show that in some ways kids are doing better. So we have this very strong idea that kids must be doing badly because we live in a messed up time. It isn't necessarily true.
So do you think, for example, that there's a kind of hysteria around antidepressants and that they're actually being underprescribed right now?
It's hard to say underprescribed necessarily, which is another blanket statement. What seems to be true is that they're being underprescribed for the kids who need them the most, the kids who really suffer from serious depression, which is grossly underdiagnosed. That is known to be true. There is some indication they may be overprescribed for very young children for whom they haven't been approved, and that's problematic. But I think generally this whole issue of medication, the idea of these antidepressants or Ritalin, has become a flashpoint for much larger worries and a much different debate about the state of childhood in our time.
And so here's the disconnect, if that's the right word, between the public perception right now and the problems that you're concerned about with this book. Listener from our on our Facebook page, without a doubt, kids are overdiagnosed and overmedicated. Even many of the doctors doing this know it, but they're driven by fear of liability for controllable behavior with bad outcomes. But you're saying that the kids who need it the most are being underdiagnosed. In fact, you say that kids from wealthier families have the highest level of diagnosis, and the most competitive schools show a disproportionate number of students with learning disabilities. So illness isn't distributed according to income in the way we might expect. You know, I think we tend to believe that troubled low-income kids get diagnosed more easily as mentally ill and that that's a way of writing them off.
And that's absolutely untrue. It's precisely those kids who are not getting mental health care, just like they're not getting very good medical care in other areas as well. It's the same problem. It's perhaps a little bit worse because often in low-income communities where people are less educated, there's still a lot of urban myths circulating about what mental illness is, what causes it, and what should be done about it, and a lot of fear.
Judith Warner, author of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, and Denise in Mountainside. You're on WNYC. Hello, Denise.
Hi. I want to say I love your show. I've been listening a long time.
Thank you so much.
So I have a son, a 9-year-old son, and 2.5 years ago he was diagnosed with ADHD, and I didn't want to believe it. His grandparents still don't really believe it, but there are a lot of issues that I see with him that fall outside the normal range. He has very poor balance. He's always had muscle weakness. There are physical things that go along with ADHD that I don't think people quite recognize.
I think that's absolutely true, Denise. I think that these problems are so complex and affect children in so many areas of their lives. ADHD has been presented in the media as just being a problem of badly behaved, wiggly boys, and that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And that misses the whole range of cognitive and emotional and social problems, and as you're describing, sometimes even physical issues that can go along with this disorder, also completely misses the degree to which children with this disorder actually suffer in their lives, how they're held back in their lives.
And I really do believe that in the days of farming and vo-tech schools, that the Wiggly Boys maybe were just shipped out to work on an engine, and maybe you didn't see it. But when they are expected to sit in a chair for 7 hours from the age of six, you're going to see it, because it's a different kind of experience that kids have now. Very different than when I grew up in the 70s, where kindergarten was 2 hours with a nap, and where now, you know, you've got to be reading in kindergarten, because they're worried that if you're not reading well by second grade, you can't take the tests that make the school look really good.
And what is that like for you, Denise? Because I'm just judging from your voice here that you wouldn't be happy if your son was sent to vo-tech or out to work on the trains.
Actually, I never lived on a farm. I'm born and bred in New Jersey, but I'm looking for a private school for him that maybe offers a lot more hands-on.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, maybe kids can put together a computer instead of an engine. But, you know, as a middle-class parent that's had trouble with this economy like a lot of other families, private school is really expensive. Mm. And if you have a smart middle-class kid, ADHD isn't considered something that you get a lot of help for. So everything we've done for him, from therapy in the pool to one-on-one tutoring, it's all been private-based. His medication is off the list of our insurance plan. Mm. It's all on us. And I don't think people realize. People, I think, have this image of, oh, they're just doing it to get extra help.
Yeah.
We've spent tens of thousands of dollars on him, and we're doing it all on our own.
Denise, I'm so glad you called. I think it's important for a lot of people to hear you, and I'm sure a lot of parents are identifying with you right now. Judith?
I've heard this kind of story over and over again. People don't have proper coverage to be able to cover the costs that they're incurring when they have kids with mental health issues. And there is this idea that parents are trying to just rip off the system. You have all of these stories in the media about wealthy parents who try to get school systems to pay for their kids' special ed or private schools because they opt out of the public schools, like Tom Freston, the former CEO of Viacom, was the biggest example, or parents in Connecticut who are trying to get the school systems just to pay for horseback riding or personal trainers. And the truth is, what you've just described, middle-class parents struggling to cover medication, to cover additional tutoring. And also, I hear, and this is so typical too, that you've tried so many things other than medication, that you're not just narrowly viewing this as a kind of pop a pill issue. And I heard this over and over again from parents. They try everything they can to help their kids, with medication being often the last resort.
A challenge from our comments page to you from RCT, who writes, our child was pathologized by schools that tolerated very little deviation from a so-called behavioral norm. One psychiatrist acknowledged to me that the issue was adaptation, not a disorder, but pointed out to me that adaptation was important for success. We fought tooth and nail to keep him from being medicated, and we won. He has struggled in school, but has learned to adapt and is now in college. He thanks us for not having medicated him. Judith has drunk the Kool-Aid. She is too willing to listen to authority figures and takes medications for herself for migraines. Our own experience taught us to be wary of drugs.
That is true that I take medication for migraines. I'm not sure that
You blogged about that, right?
Yes, I have. I've written about that. Positive and negative experience with the medications. But I'm not sure it's necessarily linked in my mind to what I've come to think about kids and medication. But what strikes me in this story from the listener is that there wasn't anything wrong with his son. I mean, the psychiatrist said there wasn't an issue there. If there was pressure being put on the family to medicate this child, well, then maybe that was a misguided school. But this is clearly a situation where the parents did what due diligence they needed to do in order to follow their gut about what was right for their child, and they weren't sort of, the child wasn't put in a box by a psychiatrist. I think that the perception is that psychiatrists are constantly trying to normalize children and just drug them. So this sounds like a success story rather than a cautionary tale.
And what about this charge that, you know, if you've got this position, then you've drunk the Kool-Aid of authority figures. Have reports of psychologists' ties, not to mention journalist ties, to the pharmaceutical industry, but particularly mental health professionals' ties to the pharmaceutical industry, undermine the fact that medications might be absolutely often crucial in treating some of these illnesses?
Absolutely. The psychiatrists have shot themselves in the foot, so has the pharmaceutical industry for that matter. But you have stories that are absolutely outrageous about psychiatrists being in the pay of drug makers, hiding the extent of their financial links from the institutions that they work for. You had a series of stories showing how psychiatrists in the Midwest were prescribing higher levels of atypical antipsychotics, which are powerful drugs that have very dangerous side effects to children, sometimes drugs that hadn't yet been approved for use in children, and the more they were paid, the more that they did this. This undermines child psychiatry enormously, and hopefully, and I think that it has begun, the profession is doing a job now on trying to kind of clean itself out from these practices so that it can regain credibility.
We'll continue in a minute. We have so many people who want to talk, and we'll let as many of you do as time allows. For Judith Warner, author of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, this week's online video picks are now up on our website. Each week we select five web videos, and I anchor them in a picks video on our site. Our picks this week include the late historian Howard Zinn, who passed away recently, on why fighting in World War II turned him into a pacifist. See all our five weekly video picks at wnyc.org/video. We continue with Judith Warner, whose work you may know from the New York Times and the Times Magazine. Her new book is called We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. And as you hear, she's taking what for many is kind of a politically incorrect position on some of this, under diagnosis, under medication, her bigger concerns than over and over. And Rich in Livingston, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Great show. My view might be interesting. Besides being a surgeon, I have a child with autism, and I have a child with ADHD and anxiety. Having listened to a number of comments, with Big Pharma, what they're doing isn't any different than what they do with other drugs. Someone has to develop these drugs, so people need to take this with a grain of salt. Having visited a number of different psychiatrists and psychologists, the difficulty with diagnosis is there's no exact measurement. This is all subjective. There are no tests. There's no blood work and so forth. So different people will render different diagnoses even for the same child. But, in our experience, unfortunately, so much of this is fueled by an educational system that just does not meet the needs of kids. And for far too long, kids are, if they can't sit still, listen and write neatly, they're labeled as stupid, and kids who can are labeled bright. So
having been through this as much as you have, what would you change?
That's a multifactorial question. Our educational system has to change and address the needs of kids and realize that one system doesn't fit all. Drug companies market these drugs, but the reality is there's very little data out there. Most of the drugs are being used hoping that the side effects of these drugs will work. There's very little science behind it. There's hardly any science behind, multiple drug combinations.
Judith, you want to react to that? You're nodding.
Yes, please.
Yes, I was nodding along with what you just said about there being hardly any science behind multiple drug combinations. That is a scary development. You have a lot of kids now who are taking more than one drug. Sometimes they're taking three or four. Sometimes they're taking multiple medications because they're trying to medicate away the side effects of a first drug. We have to understand the distress that these kids are in and that parents are in that lead them to the situation where they'll do that. But it's a bad situation, and there ought to be better science, and there's frankly no excuse for there not being better science, given the fact that the drug companies get a pass, they get, privileges, basically, from the FDA for being able to do pediatric research, and the research is just not good enough, and it's not trustworthy enough.
Rich, thank you, and good luck. And there's a giant gulf, isn't there, between parents whose kids are untouched by mental health issues and parents of those who are. Tell me why this gulf is significant.
I think it's just one of those things where there's a gulf of experience, and if you're on the side of it where you haven't yet had the experience or been very close to someone who has, you just can't understand it. It's a little bit like parenthood itself. You really don't know what it feels like until you've gone through it. I think that that gulf of experience leads to a lot of problems. It leads people to overgeneralize from their own lives and their own experiences to make assumptions about these parents and these kids. As one woman who I interviewed, who's quoted early in the book, actually a woman who had commented on nytimes.com, said, people are sad, so they think they understand depression. They get distracted, so they think they understand ADHD. They worry, so they think they understand anxiety. But in fact, they have no idea of what it really feels like to have problems to the level where it can be called a disorder.
Melanie in Manhattan with a teacher's perspective. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I teach second grade, and I just wanted to say I've seen that sometimes there's a lot of resistance on the part of families and parents to, you know, there's so much stigma that people associate with labels and testing. And so, you know, sometimes it becomes clear even for younger kids that they might need some kind of help, but there's so much resistance that, you know, we find sometimes from coming from families.
And so what do you say when you hear families who are resistant and might think that what you're looking for, well, not to say that you're bad and, you know, malintended, but that what you want is a certain level of easiness when you have a class full of 30 kids or however many?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to just say that so many teachers know we do so much with differentiation and just addressing different needs in the classroom. I think there is more awareness of different styles of kids. I mean, I think what you say is we want to do everything possible to help from an educational perspective. And, you know, there are so many different services that schools offer that if we do recommend a certain type of course of action that may include medication, I think it's all for, you know, the benefit of the child and to help them. And also, I just think that the, you know, kind of stigma and labels from 20 or 30 years ago are very different now in terms of special education and, you know.
Judith?
I think that's such an important point to make in terms of how times have changed. And I think there's this default setting people have when they think about teachers and schools, which is similar to the default setting they have with parents, which is pure prejudice. Teachers are just trying to calm these kids down and shut them up so that their lives will be easier. It doesn't take into account at all, as you said, the differentiated education that you now try to do, the fact that teachers generally do care about children. That's why they're doing the jobs that they're doing. Again, it's this default setting, this negativity. And I think it's really important to say that the way we talk about children's mental health issues now, the way we talk about the lazy pill-pushing parents and the kids who are just badly behaved and being stuffed full of meds for nothing, this is stigma. This is the modern face of mental health stigma in our time. There are a lot of forms of prejudice that are no longer socially acceptable in our country, things that people don't say, don't even necessarily permit themselves to think. But in this area, it is still permissible to spout sheer prejudice.
Thank you for your call, Melanie. We're going to run out of time in about 2 minutes. What would you say as a starting point to parents who are wary of pharmaceuticals, who don't want to medicate their kids, but who are also seeing their kids suffering? You know, we know you've been critical of Big Pharma in the past, but Big Pharma isn't going away, and these parents are facing all kinds of dilemmas.
I would say find a doctor you can trust, with whom you can have a real relationship, with whom you can spend some real time and talk and figure out what's really going on with your child. It's hard to do this. This is easier said than done. This takes time. It takes a doctor who's willing to give a long appointment, let's say. It can be a pediatrician. It's great when it's a pediatrician who can be kind of a medical home for the child and then be able to make referrals to specialists if necessary. Most people don't have access to that kind of time with a pediatrician, and that's really too bad. But find someone trustworthy to talk to.
And after all your research, what's wrong with our healthcare system? Should anything be included in healthcare reform legislation that they're discussing in Washington that would speak to any of these issues?
Well, at this point, they're just looking at coverage, at getting people covered, rather than the ins and outs of it. But eventually, when the time comes, obviously, we're going to have much better reimbursement for mental health services than we have now. People are not, the woman who called in earlier and said she's not getting covered even for medication, much less the specialized tutoring or therapy. People need, if they're going to give their kids really top-notch care, they have to be able to pay for it.
And that woman said that the particular drug they were using for her son wasn't covered by her health insurance, so that's an issue too. Judith Warner is the author of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. So many of you are on hold that we're not going to be able to get to. Our apologies. You can keep the conversation going with each other. Maybe you can help each other out a lot, seriously, on our webpage. We have a page for this where you can write at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Tonight, Judith Warner will be at the Parents League of New York. That's at 6:30 this evening, an onstage conversation with New York Times columnist and takeaway contributor Lisa Belkin. That's the Parents League of New York. The All Souls Unitarian Church is hosting this at Lexington Avenue and 80th Street in Manhattan. It's free and open to the public, and registration is suggested but not required. They say call the Parents League offices at 212-737-7385 or go to parentsleague.org, parentsleague.org, for that 6:30 event tonight. Judith Warner, thank you very much for an
important conversation. Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC.